drawing room over here.
Hey, it's great to see you. We've been waiting. There's heaps to talk about. When the body of a woman was found in a park in Singapore, nobody knew who she was. No one had reported her missing, and the only clue investigators had to go on was a series of tiny numbers etched into her dental implants. When it comes to stories about crime, the truth is often stranger than fiction. And no one knows that better than my next guest, Liz Porter. She's a true crime author, and her new book, Crime Scene Asia, examines 16 cases from Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, the Philippines and Indonesia. She's my guest in the drawing room. Liz, welcome.
Thank you, Damien.
You've written about Australia before, but why have you headed out this time to the broader Australian, or the broader Asian region?
Well, it was one of those, it seemed like a great idea at the time moments. I was in Singapore on a conference and I'm always on the lookout for something new to write about because I've always felt you can't write the same book again. So my first book, Written on the Skin, was a look at all the different forensic specialities and cases that were good examples. And over the years after that, I kept thinking, oh, that's a good case. But I just didn't want to do Written on the Skin part two. So I thought, I have to wait until something interesting comes up. So there I was in Singapore and I looked in bookshops and I saw shelves, in fact, a whole wall in one bookshop of books about feng shui. I thought, And then I saw there were no books about true crime, or hardly any, just a couple of shelves. But there was a burgeoning interest, it seemed to me, in crime. There was a series called Singapore Noir of short stories about Singapore. There was KL Noir. There was Hong Kong Noir. So I thought, okay, if they're starting to be interested in crime fiction, maybe there'll be a market for these stories of mine, which I like to write as if they were fiction, but they are true stories with the forensics just right.
And Liz, how did you choose the cases? What for you made a good subject, a good fascinating yarn that you wanted to explore further?
Well, it's really interesting you asked that, Damien, because there are actually not that many cases that are eligible. For me, there's basically the criterion is, does this sound like it could be in a movie? If it does, then it's for me. If it doesn't, crucially, the forensics has to be crucial to the story in some way. You know, in an ideal story, the forensics are the key to the story. So there's a case in Malaysia, it's called Unknown Male One, where the truth was only to be found in the forensic detail. And that was a truth that the police didn't want to know about. A lovely young woman called Narita was murdered and police arrested her lover.
A married, respectable father of three or four children.
Yes, a man called Hanif. He was an engineer and tall, handsome, lovely man. But suddenly there he is under arrest. And yet there was other evidence to suggest that somebody else had been seen at the time, the hours around her death. She had two flatmates, this woman, and as they came home, they saw a shadow sort of fleeing the flat. They smelt an awful kind of body odour smell, and this was quite a crucial thing because Hanif, besides being lovely and handsome and having a good job, was also a very well-groomed man, and one of his friends testified of having driven with him, you know, in the car, and, you know, he always smelled lovely. And there was this really terrible smell in the apartment.
And he was also tall.
And he was also tall, yes.
And the flatmate said quite a short man
exactly
sort of in the corridor.
But the police didn't want to know any of this, really.
And that's where the forensic evidence stepped in and stopped this man from spending his life in jail for
and
murder.
And he had a very good lawyer because the police were just determined to have this guy. In fact, there was more than one appeal by the prosecution, but each time the judges rejected it. I mean, and in fact, my impression of Malaysian policing from the two cases in the book is not hugely favourable, but the court system seems to hold up.
Look, I was going to ask you about that later on because, you know, you're looking at a number of very, very different societies, very different countries, and they'll have different types of police forces, they'll have different kinds of court systems, they might have different standards in their laboratories, and all of those things are going to have a big, big impact on the way the justice system operates.
Absolutely. And the cases that I excluded from the book were excluded often on this basis. I mean, my only Indonesian case is the Bali bombing, for the reason that there was another case that I heard about, and it got quite a lot of news coverage here, a young woman who was poisoned with a milkshake.
But by somebody who'd spent a lot of time in Australia.
Yes.
So that case actually attracted a lot of attention here because of the Australian connection.
And I thought, oh, this would be good. But with a little bit of the investigation of I did around the back of it and talking to at least one of the forensic scientists who was involved, I just wasn't happy with it. And he wasn't happy with it either. The material they were given to work with wasn't good. And he had very little confidence in the fairness of the system around the hearing of this case. So I thought, no, this is not one that I want to feature. I'm kind of a bit of a forensic Pollyanna. I want these stories to be an example of good forensic science being used in the way that it should be. And so that's why I left Thailand out completely, because there is one very good forensic pathologist in Thailand, a woman called Dr. Pornchip, who is, if anyone saw the rather long SBS documentary after the tsunami, she featured there. And she has her own institute in Thailand, but the police don't actually use her. She's normally at war with the police. So I thought, well, I can't. And one case that I looked at in Thailand, I just, again, wasn't happy. There was so much corruption around the gathering of evidence around who was arrested. I thought, no, I can't do it. I don't want to do it. Mm. So that's why I picked on these cases.
Mm. So I want to come back to some of the other countries that you've focused on. But before we do that, you tended in this book to talk to lawyers. In your previous books, you've tended to focus more of your conversations on the scientists.
Yes.
Why this time did you focus on the lawyers?
Well, it's really wasn't a choice, Damien, unfortunately. How the book started was I was in Singapore and at this conference, think, yes, I'll do the book. Went out to the Health Sciences Authority in Singapore, which is the equivalent of the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine, was welcomed with open arms by a senior forensic pathologist there. He told me lots of cases. I left there with huge excitement in a notebook full of notes, thought, right, here's my next book. He even gave me books to read, suggestions. So went home, did more research, contacted a publisher, had a contract. Then I'm ready to start work. And I email him again to say, no, like this case, can you tell me this and this? And suddenly he's, oh, I'm really sorry. I would love to help you, but my boss doesn't want me to do this. And that was pretty much the story that was repeated all around Australia. In fact,
all
around Asia. Usually, though, I didn't get as far as that. But there was one thing that had happened. One other scientist who had refused to speak to me was an English scientist or Scottish scientist called Sheila Hamilton. She told me about a particular case, or rather I had read about it and then she told me a bit more. And she said, look, I don't want to talk about this, but maybe you could talk to the defence lawyer on the case, a guy called Peter Levac. And so a quick Google, and I realised he was in Sydney. And he had such a fabulous story to tell. And this was a case which involved a real stumble-bum, petty crim type who had agreed to basically be a driver and deliverer for something. He didn't really want to know what he was getting involved in. He thought it was something to do with illegal gambling, which was in his world quite okay. But it turned out that he was actually a delivery boy for one of the two biggest gangsters in Hong Kong ever to pick up an AK-47 and hold up people in a jewellery shop. He was in deep, deep trouble. Basically, he was involved with a huge cache of explosives, and these explosives were, it's suggested, aimed to blow up Stanley Prison. This was never established, but he had the huge cache of explosives. It was enough to basically raise two or three city blocks in Hong Kong. It was a seriously dangerous amount of explosives.
So you've got these two larger-than-life characters,
yeah,
and the accused is at the centre of your story, who's this kind of tiny, tiny little two-bit crim.
But he's being treated like a terrorist, and he's in the dock. Anyway, my hero, you know, the lawyer Peter Levac, got him off with forensic science because it turned out that the suspect, Mr. Chan, had ammonium nitrate all over him. It was all over his clothing and his hands, which suggested that he had been handling the goods, and which didn't fit with his story of not knowing what it was. But the forensic genius here was that the hut where all the explosives had been stored was in the New Territories, which is a very agricultural area. And there's ammonium nitrate, as well as being a key component of bombs, is also a fertilizer. So all the earth around there was full of ammonium nitrate. And Chan had been arrested after a fight with police, you know, rolling around in the dirt. And the mistake that the Hong Kong police made when during all the arrests were, while they swabbed the suspects for ammonium nitrate or whatever they could find off them, gunshot residue, anything, they didn't swab themselves. So it may be that the police might have had it all over themselves too, but nobody knew. So that doubt was enough to get him off.
You're listening to The Drawing Room on RN Drive with me, Damien Carrick, and my guest this evening is the wonderful Liz Porter. She's the author of a new book, Crime Scene Asia. One of the most interesting stories is not set in Asia, but it's actually set in Sydney. Tell me about a case which I think you describe as one of the great miscarriages of justice, you know, up there with some of the ones in WA or even Lindy Chamberlain. But for whatever reason, it's kind of gone under the radar. We don't recognise it for what it is. That's your view. Tell me about that case.
Yeah, this involves a Singaporean young man called Ram Tiwari. And I remain astounded that I had never heard of this case. My Singapore publishers wanted me to put it in the book because he's a Singaporean, and they figured for their readership it would be interesting. And this young man, in 2003, he woke up early one afternoon because he was a bit of a night owl, very much a nightclub animal, I think, and to find his two flatmates dead, in a very, very bad state. They had been savagely attacked. And he had slept through the first attack, it seems. He had heard movement outside his door with the second murder, and he'd been too afraid to leave his room, which was embarrassing, I suppose, and is the cause of what were later called by the prosecution his lies, because he told later, he would tell friends that he wasn't home at the time because he just didn't really want to talk about it. And of course, everyone was interested. And to say, as a man, and a man who was actually in Sydney on an armed forces scholarship, so he was a trained soldier, to say, I was too afraid to leave my room, it might have been easy for him to say, well, no, I wasn't there. And so the prosecution later turned that back on him, and they had a procession of people through the court saying he told me this and he told me that, so just trying to establish that he was a liar. But basically there was no evidence which tied him to the murders. The murder weapon was a baseball bat, which he had bought, but he bought it to play baseball. He had virtually no blood on him. The only blood he had on him, with a few spatters on his feet, were entirely consistent with him having rushed to look at his second flatmate to see if he was still alive and had taken his pulse. His dying flatmate had coughed, which is a very common thing to do, and some of the blood, it was blood spatter on his feet. And that was, the judge in the first case even found that that was an entirely probable explanation. But for reasons that continue to escape me, two juries, because the jury in the first case found him guilty, there was an appeal. The jury in the second case found him guilty.
And then what happened?
Then there was another appeal, and the three judges of the Supreme Court, who I'm told were the best judges, they actually looked at the forensic evidence which the other trial judges were supposed to have done as well, and did do, and looked at it and said, really, it's just kind of impossible. To me, it's a bit like the Sherlock Holmes story about the curious incident of the dog in the night. The crucial thing is the dog failed to bark, and the failure to bark was as powerful as a piece of evidence. And in this case, the fact that there was no evidence in the flat at all of him having washed himself, Ram Tiwari having washed himself. And it's just inconceivable that he could have committed these two brutal murders. There would have been blood everywhere. There was blood everywhere in the flat, but there would have been blood on him. And he'd gone nowhere. The taps hadn't been run. It's impossible. Somebody else must have come and committed the crimes and then left. And even the case, the prosecution case, was that the two men had both been killed with the baseball bat. Well, in fact, the second man that was established, the second man to die, had bits of the shrink plastic wrapping in his wounds from the baseball bat. So it was new and had been only used on the second guy. The first guy, no shrink plastic wrapping in his wounds at all. So he clearly wasn't even attacked with the baseball bat. There was another weapon, and that was something that was completely brushed over by the prosecution.
So in this case, the forensic evidence, or if you like, the lack of forensic evidence, what was the most important thing? And that's really what's in common with all of these extraordinary stories and tales that you tell in the book.
Yeah, yes. And so that's what I always look for in a case. And unless it's such an extraordinary front story, the actual the details of the case are somehow amazing. But mostly, what I want is the forensic evidence to be crucial to the outcome.
Well, it's a crucial read. Liz Porter has been my guest in The Drawing Room, and her new book, Crime Scene Asia, is out now. Liz, lovely talking to you.
Thank you, Damien.
That's it for the show tonight. Patricia Karvelas will be back with you tomorrow evening. And you can listen to any conversation from the show whenever you want. Just go to the RN website or the ABC Listen app and look for RN Drive. Coming up next, Australia-wide. Have a great night.